Readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and this is going to be one Yankee Doodle Dandy show. We're going to celebrate America with books and authors from sea to shining sea. We'll cover great milestones in history, beloved genres, and titles creating more than their fair share of fireworks. Let's get started.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Comedian and writer Albert Brooks has been all over late-night TV lately, talking about his new project, 2030, the real story of what happens to America. So here's the scenario. June 12, 2030 starts out like any other day. Since cancer has been cured 15 years before, America's population is aging, and frankly, the olds are still around in record numbers, sucking up benefits and draining resources dry. And for this, young people are simmering with resentment. But on that June 12th, everything changes. A massive earthquake devastates Los Angeles, and the government, teetering on the bridge of bankruptcy, is unable to respond. The fallout from the earthquake sets in motion a sweeping novel of ideas that pits national hope for the future against assurances from the past. The book is populated by a memorable cast of refugees and billionaires, presidents and revolutionaries, all struggling to find their way. In 2030, Brooks' imagining of where today's challenges could lead us tomorrow makes for very thought-provoking listening. Dick Hill narrates.
It was a normal day. Or so it seemed. Actually, nothing in 2030 seemed normal. Not to Brad Miller, anyway. Brad was surprised at how many people showed up for his 80th birthday. Surprised because he had these friends in the first place, and surprised at how healthy they all were. This was not what people in their 80s were supposed to look like. Sure, the lifts helped, along with the tucks and the hair and the new weight loss drug, which, while only 7 years on the market, had become the biggest selling drug in the history of the world. That's what happens when a chemical works almost 100% of the time in everyone. But still, Brad thought, these folks look good. And they did. They were thin, healthy, all looking better than their parents were at 40. The only thing missing were younger people. Brad couldn't remember the last time he'd seen a young person at his birthday. Other than his son, whom he never talked to anyway, he didn't even know anyone under 50. Nor did any of his friends. There was just too much resentment and too much fear. As the lights dimmed, the customary life movie played in the middle of the room, holographic style. People were getting tired of these. It was one thing to watch home movies of someone else. It was another to feel like you were in them. It was like boredom squared. But people watched. They laughed and told Brad how much fun it was to see him age. He, like many of them, actually looked better now than he had 10 years ago. But it was funny. Where once that was a compliment relating to how you lived your life, whether you ate well or exercised enough or got a good night's sleep, now it was just about what you could afford. And once cancer had been cured, the youth business went crazy. Most people in that room were only in their 20s when Richard Nixon declared a war on cancer. Like all the wars going on at the time, this one seemed to have little success. The progress was so slow. Still, people held out hope that when they got older, there would be a cure for what ailed them. But when the year 2000 rolled in, there they were, bald, fat, and ugly. And there was still cancer. But everyone in that room, probably everyone in the world, remembered where they were when they heard the news. Oh, there had been so many hopeful stories over the years, so many false starts, so many mice that were cured. But when the human trials started, people dropped dead of all kinds of things that had never bothered a mouse. But then it happened. And like all of the greatest discoveries, from Newton to Einstein, Dr. Sam Mueller's cure was so exquisitely simple. Dr. Mueller was no genius. He grew up fairly normal in Addison, Illinois. A big night out was going to Chicago for pizza. After graduating Rush Medical College, Sam Mueller interned at Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Medical Center, and then, realizing that making a living as an internist was going to be tough at best, he started looking elsewhere. He thought of concierge medicine, which was all the rage, but decided to take a fairly lucrative position at Pfizer. He figured he would do that for a while, and then something would unfold. Oh my, did it unfold. Mueller had always been interested in the immune system. So much in medicine was pointing to the body's own defenses as a cure-all, but the success rates were modest, at best. He was assigned various projects at Pfizer. Some were interesting, some he hated. He never understood the Viagra for women thing.
Readers, I've shared before, I worked at the Miami Herald for 15 years. So it's no surprise I always gravitate towards books by newspaper guys. And I think Tabloid City, a new title by Pete Hamill, is worth the headlines it's making on book review pages. Hamill was born in Brooklyn, the first of seven children of Catholic immigrants from Belfast, Northern Ireland. He had his first newspaper job at age 11, delivering the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. In the summer of 1960, Hamill went to work as a reporter for the New York Post. In 62, a prolonged newspaper strike led him to write magazine articles. By the fall of 63, he was in Europe as a correspondent for the Saturday Evening Post. He roamed Europe, interviewing actors, movie directors, novelists, and ordinary citizens. Hamill returned to New York in August 64 and worked at the New York Herald Tribune as a feature writer. In the fall of 65, he started writing a column for the New York Post. By Christmas, he was in Vietnam. His newspaper career would go on for decades at the Post, the New York Daily News, the Village Voice, and New York Newsday. He served briefly as the editor of the Post and later as editor-in-chief of the Daily News. His longer articles have appeared, to list a few, in New York Magazine, The New Yorker, Esquire, Playboy, and Rolling Stone. Now, in Tabloid City, Hamill tells the tale of a wealthy socialite and her secretary who are murdered in a stately West Village townhouse. In the 24 hours that follow, a flurry of activity circles around their shocking deaths. The head of one of the city's last tabloids stops the presses. A cop investigates the killing. A reporter chases the story. A disgraced hedge fund manager flees the country. An Iraq war vet seeks revenge. And an angry extremist plots a major catastrophe. As much a thriller as it is a gripping portrait of the city of today, Tabloid City is a great read from a writer who's been getting it right for decades. It's performed by Peter Gannon and Ellen Archer.
He sees the Fonseca kids squinting at his computer screen, seeing nothing else, only the people he has interviewed hours earlier, far from the city room. Briscoe leans over Logan's shoulder, glances up at the big green four-sided copper clock hanging from the ceiling, a clock salvaged from Pulitzer's world, thinking, still plenty of time. "What else do we have?" he says, dropping coat and jacket over a blank computer monitor. The early editions of the morning papers are scattered on the desk, the Times, the Post, the News. Logan clicks on a page that shows four possible versions of the wood, the page one headline. Briscoe thinks, I'm so old. He remembers seeing page one letters actually cut from wood in the old composing room of the Post, 6 blocks down West Street. The muffled sound of linotype machines hammering away from the composing room. Most of the operators, deaf mutes, signaling to each other by hand. Paul San, trimming stories on the stone counters beyond the linotype machines, his editor's hands using calipers to pluck lines of lead from the bottom of stories. Everybody smoking, crushing butts on the floor. Hot type. Shouts. Sandwiches from the Greeks. All gone forever. One possible front page says, Jobs Rising? With a subhead, Mayor says Future Bright. New unemployment numbers are due in the morning. The AP story will lead what they now call the doom page, always page 5, the hard stuff about the financial mess, with a sidebar trying to make the recession human. Names, faces, losers, pain. If they have jobs, it's a recession. If they don't have jobs, it's a depression. Foreign news is on page 8, usually from AP and Reuters. No overseas bureaus anymore, plus features bought from a new web service that has correspondents all over the planet. Obama mourns Afghan deaths. Plus a thumbsucker out of the one-man Washington bureau. The problem is that most readers don't give a rat's. Not about Iraq, not about Afghanistan, only about whether they can still feed their kids next week or the week after. 2 more suicide bombings in Baghdad. Another bombing in Pakistan, a girl's school. More stats counting the dead without names or faces. It has been months since foreign news was used as wood. What else you got? Briscoe says. Logan picks up a ringing phone, whispers to the caller, but keeps clicking on the various page one displays. Bloomy's lament. All about more city job cuts, the need for a fair share of the stimulus package, the crackdown on parking permits for well-connected Pauls, the agents in Albany grabbing what is not nailed down, and closing libraries while heading for the limousines. News should be new. This is all old. With this stuff, Briscoe thinks, we might even achieve negative sales. Logan gets off the phone. Where was I? He says. Oh, yeah, the Fonseca kid got the mother. Her son was admitted to Stuyvesant 2 years ago. Now he's shot dead in the street. Logan makes some moves on the keyboard, and then Briscoe sees 6 photographs of a distraught, thin black woman pointing at a framed letter. That's the mother, Logan says. The letter is from Stuyvesant, when he was accepted. She is staring into the camera, her face a ruin, holding a framed photograph of a smiling boy in a blazer. The woman is about 35, going on 80. The quality sucks, Briscoe says. Yeah, we don't have a photographer tonight, so Fonseca shot it with a cell phone. Anyway, that's the Vic in the other picture, the dead kid, in his first year in Stuyvesant after winning a medal for debating. Logan points to a young man's body on a sidewalk, face down, chalk marks around him. Then he's dead, late this afternoon, shot 5 times. Why? The usual, Logan says. Drugs, or someone got dissed, so say the cops. Whoever really knows. But there's a doom page angle, too. The mother lost her job 6 weeks ago. They're going to throw her out of the house, and the cops think maybe the kid started dealing drugs to save the house.
In the past several weeks, every time you turn on the tube or open the paper, you are confronted with the next twist in the Wiener scandal. But let's be real, political sex scandals have always been a part of American history. Larry Flynt, yes, the Larry Flynt of Hustler magazine, famous crusader for First Amendment and privacy rights, teams up with Columbia University American history professor David Eisenbach to write One Nation Under Sex: How the Private Lives of Presidents, First Ladies, and Their Lovers Changed the Course of American History. The pair peek under the political covers to see how hidden passions have shaped public life. I saw Larry Flynt speak about the book last month. I was fascinated. Flint and Eisenbach take you back to the Founding Fathers and onward from there in a well-reasoned, well-written, and well-documented book. Today, I have as my guest co-author Dr. David Eisenbach, who also created, wrote, and hosted The Beltway Unbuckled, a two-hour History Channel special about how presidential sex shaped American history. Welcome, David. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, firstly, how did you team up with Larry Flint for the book? Who brought the two of you together?
I did a show for the History Channel on the sex lives of presidents called The Beltway Unbuckled. And Larry Flint's a big fan of the History Channel. And so the next morning, he gave me a call. I was in my office up at Columbia. And he said, I have a business proposition for you. When can you come to L.A.? So I was on the next plane to Los Angeles, and he just pitched me on this crazy idea of teaming the two of us up, the professor and the pornographer, to explore the sex lives of presidents and first ladies.
Okay, that sounds like a TV show right there, the professor and the pornographer.
We're actually pitching it to TV networks right now.
Okay. Well, the first chapter is entitled Founding Flirts and Fornicators. So share your favorite story from that one.
Well, my favorite is involves Alexander Hamilton, who was the 34-year-old Secretary of the Treasury in George Washington's administration. And Hamilton at the time was working on creating the National Bank when one summer day, a 24-year-old woman named Maria Reynolds shows up at his house and tells him this story about how she was abandoned by her husband and she needed some extra money to get back to her folks. Well, Alexander Hamilton says, all right, well, I'll come by your living quarters tonight and I'll give you some money. And he shows up, and it becomes quite clear that she's interested in exchanging sex for the cash. Well, they keep on going at this for a while, and then her husband gets involved, and he starts to collect cash payments from Alexander Hamilton in return for allowing Hamilton to sleep with his wife. The Democratic-Republican opposition, Jefferson's people, who opposed the National Bank, decided to expose this affair as a way of undermining Alexander Hamilton's national banking system. Hamilton then decides, rather than deny it, he's going to go out and actually print a pamphlet explaining how this was just a private consensual relationship between three adults, and he prints out this apology, and the American public just accepts it. And Hamilton continues to create his bank, and the United States acquires a modern financial system.
Okay, a little different than what you've heard in the history books, but all right.
Now, exactly. The strange thing is that the American public also at the time was exposed to Thomas Jefferson's affair with Sally Hemings, his slave, and how he was fathering children with her. And once again, this was all public knowledge, and the American public kind of just accepted it. Like, these leaders have their private lives, and they moved on. In many ways, we're much more uptight than we were in the days of the early republic when it comes to sex and our politicians' private lives.
Well, talking about that, I was very fascinated to James Buchanan, the only bachelor president, was gay and had a longtime relationship with Alabama politician William Rufus King. In fact, they were, as you say in the book, often called Aunt Fancy and Miss Nancy. So how in the world in 1856 did Buchanan get elected if his sexual orientation was widely known?
Well, it's funny because in those days, homosexuality was absolutely unspeakable and certainly unprintable. So the newspapers couldn't even handle the subject. So he winds up winning the presidency in 1856. And what's significant with this relationship, this 32-year-long affair that he has with this Alabama slave-owning senator, is that William Rufus King indoctrinates James Buchanan, who came from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, fervently abolitionist section of the country. He indoctrinates him with the romantic notion that the slave owners were good people, that the slaves were happy, that America is better off protecting slavery rather than attacking it. So James Buchanan brings these notions into the presidency, and when the southern states start to secede in 1860 after Lincoln is elected, this president, James Buchanan, refuses to crack down on the secession. So he leaves Abe Lincoln with half a country when Lincoln comes into office in 1861. So here we have one of those cases where the private lives, and this is the main argument of the book, the private lives of the presidents and first ladies actually shape the country that we're living in today and American history.
Well, yeah, okay. Woodrow Wilson is always portrayed as a straight-laced, dare I say, a stiff guy. Yet,
yeah.
You quote him as saying he had a great capacity for loving the gentle sex. Tell us about him.
Yes. Woodrow Wilson, he just looks like a pharmacist, an apothecary's clerk, as Teddy Roosevelt put it. But the fact is, and everybody knew this, he loved the ladies. And he actually got into an affair with Mrs. Mary Peck, and that almost became a political scandal when he ran for president in 1912. But the real scandal, and the real historically important scandal, involved a woman named Edith Galt. Wilson's wife, Ellen, dies in the summer of 1914, and a few months later, he meets the widow Edith Galt, and they carry on an affair, which created a bit of a national scandal, because here's the President of the United States running around with this woman just a few months after the First Lady dies. Well, Wilson decides he's going to, just dispel all these rumors and this gossip by marrying her. Now, Edith Galt becomes his main political advisor, and he shares everything with her. During the First World War, she becomes essentially his chief of staff. She meets with ambassadors. They discuss the League of Nations and all of his plans for the post-war peace. And when he is pushing the League of Nations after the war is over, there is opposition within the Senate, and he goes on a national tour during which he has a nervous breakdown and then a stroke. Edith Galt, or Edith Wilson at this point, decides she's going to hide this fact, the president's incapacity, from the nation, from the press, and from the Congress, and she's going to run the White House on her own. And so she secretly has this little plot. The problem is, it makes it impossible to negotiate with the Senate opposition to the Treaty of Versailles and America joining the League of Nations. And as a result, the United States does not join the League, and there wasn't the U.S. presence that perhaps could have helped avoid the Second World War 20 years later.
Hmm. Okay, the next little thing I read just knocked me flat. Warren Harding wrote a poem to his mistress that opened, "I love your back, I love your breasts, daring to feel where my face rests." Okay, tell us about Carrie Phillips and her espionage.
That's right, that's right. This was Carrie Phillips, the wife of his best friend, and they begin a 17-year-long affair back in Marion, Ohio, which he continues to carry on even when he's a U.S. senator and then when he decides to run for president. Well, Carrie Phillips, once he gets the nomination for the Republican Party, she and her husband decide to blackmail the new Republican nominee. He doesn't have the cash to pay them off, so he has to go to the Republican Party bosses, who, realizing that this is going to devastate their campaign, decide to create a slush fund. So they get all these contributors to the slush fund. They pay off Carrie Phillips and a number of other mistresses of Warren G. Harding. But when he gets elected president, all these guys expect a return on their investment. So what we have in the Harding administration is the most corrupt administration in the history of American politics. They're the ones that produced the Teapot Dome scandal. The director of the Department of Veterans Affairs was selling medications, narcotics, for wounded World War I vets on the open market, all because they were looking for money back from the money they kicked in from the slush fund. Once again, this is the personal lives affecting political life.
Oh, yeah. All right. Now let's talk about first ladies for a moment. First, Dolly Madison, according to you and Mr. Flint, should be known for lots more than just the woman who saved Washington's portrait. Tell us about this little bon vivant.
Well, she was a really huge force in James Madison's administration. She was like the public face of it. James Madison was kind of a dour, quiet guy. So she was the one with the charisma to actually meet with congressmen and senators and ambassadors and push forward the administration's agenda. Well, the political opponents of James Madison didn't like this, obviously, and so they decided to try to undermine her by printing all sorts of gossip about how she was sleeping with a whole cohort of senators and congressmen and diplomats, and that she was basically running a brothel out of the White House. These stories were not true, but what's interesting is they are symptomatic of a political culture that couldn't handle a woman with tremendous amounts of power and influence. And the one way in which they could undermine her was by calling her a loose woman.
All right. Well, let's talk about for a minute Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok.
This is, you know, once again, what we tried to do in this book is get into the private lives of first ladies and their affairs, not just the president's. And Eleanor Roosevelt is a prime example. She had a romantic affair with a journalist named Lorena Hickok, who became her advisor and actually moved into the White House. In the Roosevelt White House, Franklin Roosevelt had his mistress, Missy Lehan, living in the room next to him. Eleanor Roosevelt had her mistress, Lorena Hickok, living next to her. And Lorena gets Eleanor to become a national spokesman for her great causes. And Lorena's advice holds press conferences, writes daily op-ed pieces, becomes, you know, the Eleanor Roosevelt that we know and love today, in for most part due to this relationship with Lorena Hickok.
So is it kind of understood that Lorena was Eleanor's first friend?
Eleanor had other lesbian relationships prior to this. In 1918, she caught Franklin Roosevelt having an affair with her social secretary, Lucy Mercer. And at that point, Eleanor decides to go on her own sexual odyssey, where she begins these lesbian relationships. And those are key because these relationships with Marion Davies and Nancy Dickerman open her mind up to feminism and civil rights. Prior to these relationships, she does not support the women's right to vote or the Equal Rights Amendment. And she has these racist views that from her childhood. Well, they re-educate her and get her to become a kind of passionate spokesman for women's rights and for civil rights. So once again, you know, we see those connections. Eleanor Roosevelt wouldn't have become the great hero of history without these personal relationships.
All right. So did you time the release of this book for the start of the 2012 presidential campaign? And are you already writing the sequel?
Well, we always knew that it was going to be topical. Right now in America, we average a political sex scandal every 6 months. I wrote that in the book. And sure enough, as soon as it comes out, we get Arnold Schwarzenegger, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, John Edwards gets indicted, Anthony Weiner, of course. So, you know, no matter when we put this thing out, it was going to be topical because the fact is, politics and power and sex go together, and there's always going to be political sex scandals. It'll always be topical.
Well, it certainly was a really enjoyable book, and I have a master's in history and political science, so you don't have to be a political scientist to really enjoy reading your book. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Bye, David.
Bye.
The Final Storm, a novel of the war in the Pacific, opens a new front in Jeff Shara's gripping chronicle of World War II as soldiers, sailors, and Marines sacrifice all for one final push toward victory in the Pacific. As the war in Europe winds down in the wake of the Normandy invasion, the U.S. turned its vast military resources towards an all-out effort against the Japanese. With a narrative befitting his status as a master storyteller, Shara relates the story of the struggle for Okinawa through the eyes of the combatants on both sides. And, with fights raging across the Pacific, a different kind of campaign is being waged in extraordinary secrecy. The development of a weapon so powerful, not even the scientists who build it know just what they are about to unleash. A fitting conclusion to a riveting military fiction saga, The Final Storm illuminates the heroism and sacrifice that defined the war in the Pacific. It's read by Paul Michael.
The story of the end of the war in the Pacific pushes us toward a delicate line between what we know to be simple history, the facts, and what many of us prefer to think should have happened. 65 years after the event, many of us sit in judgment on the way the Second World War was brought to a close, some of us wondering if there could have been a better way, or perhaps a more moral way, to end the war. In the American psyche, those debates are likely to continue for a very long time. But those debates will not be found here. This story attempts to complete what I began in a trilogy that dealt with the war in Europe. Those stories involved America's first involvement in the fight against the Germans and concluded with the fall of Hitler. Half a world away, there had been another, far more brutal war, against an enemy who was even more successful than Hitler in conquering a vast swath of territory and threatening to slice off an enormous part of the world from our definition of civilization. Had the Japanese been allowed to maintain the empire they sought and nearly won, all of Asia, including China, Korea, and Indochina, Thailand, Burma, and Malaya, would have become part of an empire that would also have included Australia, New Guinea, the Philippines, Indonesia, and the thousands of islands that spread from those lands all the way east to Hawaii and north to the Aleutians. What might have followed is speculation, of course. Would the Japanese have invaded the United States, which was one purpose of the conquest of the islands in the Aleutian chain, to serve as a base for such an operation? Or, strengthened by the raw materials drawn from the riches of the lands under their control, would the Japanese have been strong enough to shove their armies across India or drive southward to Central and South America? The urgency of meeting the challenge in the Pacific seemed to many Americans to be secondary to the threat posed to our allies by Hitler. Despite the grotesque insult inflicted upon the United States by the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor, the government, particularly President Roosevelt, understood that Germany's conquest of Europe, including England, was a more immediate threat. And so greater resources were poured out of American factories toward that part of the world. But the Pacific was hardly ignored. After Pearl Harbor, the United States struck back at the Japanese, and in what now seems an amazing feat, fought both wars simultaneously against two very different enemies in two very different ways. Though my plan had been to complete this story with Europe, I could not just walk away without touching upon the Pacific. I was also inspired by letters received from a number of Marines who were quite vocal that ignoring their story was altogether inappropriate. It's hard to disagree. Some have written to me, expressing frustration that I am not attempting to tell the entire story of the Pacific campaigns through another complete trilogy. There are reasons for that, which include the requirements of my publisher. My choice was to follow no less than Victory in rough chronological order and move through the spring and summer of 1945 to the final collapse of Japan. Thus, this story deals with the extraordinary fight on Okinawa, and then an event unique in world history, the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. The points of view vary considerably. Some are familiar: Admiral Chester Nimitz, President Harry Truman. Others are perhaps less well known: Colonel Paul Tibbets, General Mitsuru Ushijima, General Curtis LeMay. And then there are the unknown: Marine Private Clay Adams, Dr. Okiro Hamashita, whose voices have carried me far deeper into this story than I expected to go. If you are looking for either a strident argument in favor of the atomic bomb or an apology for American immorality, you will find neither here. This story is told through the eyes of the participants, whose perspectives and decisions and experiences reflected what was happening around them. There is no judgment in hindsight, no moral verdict on my part. That just isn't my job, and never will be.
A New Take on the Old West by author Patrick DeWitt. Here's a genre we haven't visited much lately, but definitely worth a visit today. Herman Kermit Warm is going to die. The enigmatic and powerful man known only as the Commodore has ordered it. and his henchmen, brothers Eli and Charlie Sisters, will make sure of it. Though Eli doesn't share his brother's appetite for whiskey and killing, he's never known anything else. But their prey isn't an easy mark. And on the road from Oregon City to gold mining claim outside of Sacramento, brother Eli begins to question what he does for a living and whom he does it for. With the Sisters Brothers, author Patrick DeWitt pays homage to the classic Western, transforming it into an unforgettable comic tour de force. Filled with a remarkable cast of characters, losers, cheaters, and ne'er-do-wells from all stripes of life, it's a violent, lustful odyssey that's making all the must-read lists this summer. John Pruden's narration beautifully captures the grit of the Old West. Let's listen.
He poured me another drink, and I drank it. As much to myself as to Charlie, I said, "He wants to pay for a lead man, that's fine, but it's bad business to short the man underneath. I got my leg gouged out and my horse burned to death working for him." "I got my horse burned to death, too. He got us new horses." "It's bad business. Stop pouring for me like I'm an invalid." I took the bottle away and asked about the specifics of the job. "We were to find and kill a prospector in California named Herman Kermit Warm." Charlie produced a letter from his jacket pocket. This from the Commodore's scout, a dandy named Henry Morris, who often went ahead of us to gather information. "Have studied Warm for many days and can offer the following in respects to his habits and character. He is solitary in nature, but spends long hours in the San Francisco saloons, passing time reading his science and mathematics books or making drawings in their margins. He hauls these tomes around with the strap like a schoolboy, for which he is mocked. He is small in stature, which adds to this comedy, but beware, he will not be teased about his size. I have seen him fight several times, and though he typically loses, I do not think any of his opponents would wish to fight him again. He is not above biting, for example. He is bald-headed, with a wild red beard, long gangly arms, and the protruded belly of a pregnant woman. He washes infrequently and sleeps where he can, barns, doorways, or, if need be, in the streets. Whenever he is engaged to speak, his manner is brusque and uninviting. He carries a baby dragoon, this tucked into a sash slung around his waist. He does not drink often, but when he finally lifts the bottle, he lifts it to become completely drunken. He pays for his whiskey with raw gold dust that he keeps in a leather pouch worn on a long string, this hidden in the folds of his many-layered clothing. He has not once left the town since I have been here, and I do not know if he plans to return to his claim, which sits some 10 miles east of Sacramento, map enclosed. Yesterday, in a saloon, he asked me for a match, addressing me politely and by name. I have no idea how he knew this, for he never seemed to notice that I was following him. When I asked how he had come to learn my identity, he became abusive, and I left. I do not care for him, though there are some who say his mind is uncommonly strong. I will admit he is unusual, but that is perhaps the closest I could come to complimenting him. Next to the map of Warm's claim, Morris had made a smudged drawing of the man, but he might have been standing at my side and I would not have known it. It was so clumsy a rendering. I mentioned this to Charlie, and he said, "Morris is waiting for us at a hotel in San Francisco. He will point Warm out, and we will be on our way. It's a good place to kill someone, I have heard. When they are not busily burning the entire town down, they are distracted by its endless rebuilding."
"Why doesn't Morris kill him?"
"That's always your question, and I always have my answer. It's not his job, but ours."
"It's mindless. The Commodore shorts me my wage, but pays this bumbler his fee and expenses just to have Warm tipped off that he is under observation."
"You cannot call Morris a bumbler, brother. This is the first time he has made a mistake, and he admits his error openly. I think his being discovered says more about Warm than Morris."
"But the man is spending the night in the streets. What is holding Morris back from simply shooting him as he sleeps?"
"How about the fact that Morris is not a killer?"
"Then why send him at all? Why did he not send us a month ago instead?"
"A month ago, we were on another job. You forgot that the Commodore has many interests and concerns and can get to them but one at a time. Hurried business is bad business.
These are words from the man himself. You only have to admire his successes to see the truth in it.
It made me ill to hear him quote the Commodore so lovingly. I said, "It will take us weeks to get to California. Why make the trip if we don't have to?"
"But we do have to make the trip. That is the job."
"And what if Worm's not there?"
"He'll be there."
"What if he's not?"
"God damn it, he will be."
When it came time to settle, I pointed to Charlie. "The lead man's paying." Normally, we would have gone halves, so he did not like that. My brother has always been miserly, a trait handed down from our father.
In Unfamiliar Fishes, public radio darling Sarah Vowell undertakes a study of precisely how Hawaii came to be annexed by the United States in 1898. Vowell draws on a wealth of archival research and oral tradition to craft a comprehensive view of the state's less than democratic incorporation into our union. The bulk of the book is narrated by the author herself, but there is a plethora of well-known wisecrackers who help out with quotations. Listening to this varied chorus of characters is great fun. You'll hear Maya Rudolph, Fred Armisen, Bill Hader, John Hodgman, Edward Norton, Paul Rudd, Keanu Reeves, and more. Many think of 1776 as the most defining year of American history, but Vowell argues that 1898 might be a year just as crucial to our nation's identity. A year when, in an orgy of imperialism, the United States annexed Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and Guam, invaded Cuba, and then the Philippines, becoming a meddling, self-serving, militaristic international superpower practically overnight. Of all the countries the United States invaded or colonized in 1898, Vowell considers the story of the Americanization of Hawaii to be the most intriguing. With her trademark wry insights and reporting, Vowell discovers the odd, emblematic, and exceptional history of the 50th state. In examining the place where a manifest destiny got a sunburn, she finds America, warts and all.
The picture was taken in the summer of 1898, a few days after the sons of missionaries who had dethroned the Hawaiian queen handed over Hawaii to the United States. The park is pitched with the tents of the 1st New York Voluntary Infantry. The Spanish-American War had the soldiers stopping off in this suddenly American city en route to the Philippines to persuade the Filipino people at gunpoint that self-government really isn't for everyone. They named their encampment after the president who dispatched them here, Camp McKinley. The United States declared war on Spain in April of 1898. By August, the McKinley administration had invaded the Spanish colonies of Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and Guam, and annexed Hawaii. In this four-month orgy of imperialism, the United States became a world power for the first time, became what it is now. "Hurrah for Hawaii," Theodore Roosevelt wrote from Cuba when he heard the news that the U.S. annexed the islands. He was in the Caribbean with the Rough Riders, licking the Spanish at Santiago de Cuba. One of the end results of that conquest was American control of Guantanamo Bay. To Roosevelt and his like-minded cronies in the government and military, the most important objective of all the 1898 maneuvers was possession of far-flung islands for naval bases at strategic ports like Guantanamo and Honolulu's Pearl Harbor. He and his friends had pined for these bases for years the way a normal man envisions his dream house. All they ever wanted was a cozy little global empire with a few islands here and there to park a fleet of battleships. That Japanese dive bomber sank four of those battleships in Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, is how I ended up getting interested in Hawaii in the first place a few years back. The purpose of my initial visit was a quick jaunt to see the USS Arizona Memorial, the monument in the harbor perched above the oily, watery grave of the 1,177 sailors who died on the ship that day. Unlike the flip-flop wearers on my flight to Honolulu, I didn't come here for direct sunlight or fun. I came to Hawaii because it had been attacked. After I checked the Arizona off my to-do list, I still had some time to kill. So I swung by the Iolani Palace downtown, curious to take a look at the Victorian building my guidebook billed as the only palace in the United States. A guide led my tour group into the room where the white businessmen and sugar planters who had staged a coup d'etat against Queen Liliuokalani in 1893 locked her up for treason after her royalist supporters botched a counter-revolution. Liliuokalani whiled away her imprisonment in a room on the second floor of the palace, renamed the Executive Building, sewing a colorful quilt that is on display there. Perhaps out of melancholy or spite, little flags of the Kingdom of Hawaii stand guard around the quilt center square. In one corner, she embroidered a scene of a cartoonish man struggling with an umbrella, losing his hat in the wind. The guide chuckled over this quaint bit of slapstick, but I wondered if it was the sly lament of a woman whose crown has blown away and it isn't coming back. I should mention that I was there in December of 2003. The week before I arrived in Honolulu, American soldiers captured Saddam Hussein, who was hiding in his grungy spider hole outside of Tikrit. So when I was standing in the Victorian-era cell of a Polynesian queen deposed by the sons of churchy New Englanders, at that exact moment, the Iraqi dictator was behind bars in a U.S. military compound being guarded by Pennsylvanians. Not that the queen, a constitutional monarch and accomplished musician famous for writing the love song Aloha Away, and Saddam, a mass murderer famous for gassing 5,000 Kurds, had much in common. Still, there's an identifiable link between the two overthrows, an American tendency to indulge in what trendy government lingo at the time was calling regime change.
Readers, in a few weeks, I'll have the wonderful opportunity of interviewing Lisa C. Her new novel, Dreams of Joy, is topping all the lists. We'll save that audiobook preview for that show. But as this week is all about America, we're going to preview the sweeping odyssey of Lisa's Chinese-American family, On Gold Mountain. Out of stories heard in childhood in L.A.'s Chinatown and years of research, C has constructed an amazing story of racism and romance, entrepreneurial genius and domestic heartache, secret marriages and sibling rivalries in a gripping history of two cultures meeting in a new world that is America. The book is narrated by Kate Redding.
In the late afternoons, my grandmother and great-aunt Sissy would relax in wicker chairs in the back of the store over cups of strong tea. During that quiet and comfortable time, they would reminisce about the past. They told intriguing and often silly stories about missionaries, prostitutes, Tong Wars, the all-girl drum corps, and the all-Chinese baseball team. They spoke about how the family had triumphed over racist laws and discrimination. Then, as inevitably as Uncle Benny's threat of the trash can, would come my grandmother's assertion that, yes, during the war, the Lo Fan, white people, made all of us Chinese wear buttons so that they would know we weren't Japanese. My grandmother taught me how to wash the rice until the water ran clear, then, without the aid of a measuring cup, pour water over the grains in the steamer up to the first knuckle of a hand. It didn't matter if it was her knuckle or mine, she explained. For 5,000 years, the system had worked perfectly. Finally, she would place a few lengths of lop chung, a delicious pork sausage, on top to cook as the rice steamed. Meanwhile, my grandfather would be chopping ingredients. Once the rice was on, I became my grandfather's second cook. The best I ever had, he used to say. Together, although all these years later I can't remember a single thing I did, we would make up a dish of tomato beef, for which he was remembered decades after his death. At family weddings, we'd wait at our table for the bride to come by, and my grandmother would let me be the one in our group to hand over the Lai Si, good luck money, wrapped in a red envelope with gold characters of felicity and fortune limned on the outside. My grandmother would take me from table to table through huge banquet rooms, explaining who each and every person was and how they were related to me. This is your first cousin once removed. This is your third cousin. In 1989, Aunt Sissy celebrated her 80th birthday with a traditional Chinese banquet. I will always remember how my cousins and I left our banquet room to spy on the wedding taking place in the main dining room, where at least 500 guests kept tapping their chopsticks on their bowls or glasses, making an amazing racket. "Well, they must be from Taiwan," one of the cousins sneered. "You know, FOBs, fresh off the boat." Since Fong Si's first voyage and his early dubious career selling crotchless underwear to brothels, the family had become the old line, the aristocracy. No longer FOBs, we were ABCs, American-born Chinese. That evening I gave Sissy a copy of Ruth Ann Lum McCunn's book, Chinese-American Portraits, which, for all its tragedies, secrets, and illicit exploits, also conveys a powerful cultural and artistic ethos. 3 days later, my cousin Leslie called. She wanted me to know that Sissy, her mother, as well as my great-aunt and the only living child of my great-grandfather's half-Chinese, half-Caucasian family, thought it was time for a book to be written about our family, and that I was the person to write it. The following week, I was over at the store with my tape recorder, listening to the stories Aunt Sissy, my grandmother, and my cousin had to tell. That first day, I learned that Fong Si was not the first family member to come to the Gold Mountain. His father, my great-great-grandfather, had worked as an herbalist during the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. I also found out that Fong Si had not two, but four wives. All through the years, my relatives had kept these marriages a secret. Bigamy was against the law and embarrassing to his children. 2 months later, Sissy died suddenly, but Leslie encouraged me to continue with the book. Our friends and family were getting up into their 80s and 90s, she noted, and when they died, their stories would be lost. At Leslie's urging, I pressed on. My relatives, including my father, who truly were not disposed to participate, did so, I believe, to honor my great-aunt's wishes. During the last 5 years, I have interviewed close to 100 people, rich and poor, Chinese and Caucasian. I struggled with the difficulties posed by different names for the same person. Milton, Ming, Ming Ah, Ah Ming for my great-uncle, Fong Si, Sui On, and Si Bok for my great-grandfather.
My Korean deli, risking it all for a convenience store, is a sweet and funny tale of a preppy editor buying a Brooklyn deli with his Korean in-laws. It's about family, culture clash, and the quest for authentic experience. It starts with a gift. When Ben Ryder Howe's wife, the daughter of Korean immigrants, decides to repay her parents' self-sacrifice by buying them a store, Howe, an editor at the rarefied Paris Review, agrees to go along. Things soon become a lot more complicated. After the business struggles, Howe finds himself living in the basement of his in-law Staten Island home. He commutes to the Paris Review offices in George Plimpton's Upper East Side townhouse by day, and heads to Brooklyn to slice cold cuts and peddle lottery tickets by night. My Korean Deli follows the store's tumultuous lifespan and along the way paints the portrait of an extremely unlikely partnership between characters from Brooklyn to Seoul to Puritan New England. Owning the deli becomes a transformative experience for everyone involved as they struggle to salvage the original gift and the family while sorting out issues of values, work, and identity. The title is read by Bronson Pinchot.
But the truth is, I'm still young. 31 is young, right? And can afford to be blasé. It's like the job I had as a 17-year-old pumping gas outside Boston, a gig I remember as brainless heaven. I enjoyed coming home smelly. I enjoyed looking inside people's cars while scraping the crud off their windows. I enjoyed flirting with women drivers twice my age. Who knows how I would have felt if 17 were just the beginning and I could look forward to 50 more years of taking orders from strangers. Today we are looking at a deli with a steam table. This morning I was informed of the news by a fire-breathing giant, a creature escaped from a horror movie about mutants spawned by an industrial accident, who hovered at my bedside until I awoke with a start, upon which the creature said,
"For 2 weeks you be in charge of finding our store, and you not come up with anything, so starting today we do it my way."
Then the creature exited, accompanied, it seemed, to my half-asleep ears by the sound of dragging chains. For the rest of the morning I lie there under the sheets as a form of protest, not intending to get out, until my wife, Gab, sits down on the bed next to me with a cup of coffee. "I want you and my mother to go together," Gab says. "I can't come because I have things to do at home." The store is near Times Square and has a name like Luxury Farm or Delicious Mountain. Its Korean owners claim to be making $8,000 a day, a preposterous sum that nevertheless has Kay all excited.
"Don't be afraid of steam table," she says as we drive to the store. "If smelling something strange, close nose and think of big money."
I exhale deeply and try to follow her advice, but instead of fistfuls of cash, all I can think of are slabs of desiccated meatloaf slathered in congealed gravy and the smell of boiled ham. So I focus on the drive into Midtown, the glowering skyscrapers, the silhouettes of bankers and lawyers behind tinted windows a few stories above the traffic, the gigantic television screens featuring high-cheekboned models talking on cell phones, and at street level, my future comrades among the peonage, the restaurant delivery men, the tarot readers, the no-gun security guards, and the DVD bootleggers. The owner of the deli is a distressingly perky woman named Mrs. Yu. She's frizzy-haired and victimized by an excess of teeth, and she's wearing the Korean deli owner's official uniform, a puffy vest and a Yankees cap settled snugly over her Asian fro. Her age, approximately mid-50s, is the same as Kay's, which makes her part of the generation of Koreans who came to America in the 1980s and became the most successful immigrant group ever, the people who took over the deli industry from the Greeks and the Italians, the people who drove the Chinese out of the dry cleaning trade, the people who took away nail polishing from African Americans, and the people whose children made it impossible for underachievers like me to get into the same college as our parents had attended.
"My name Gloria Yu," she says when we walk in. "My store make you rich,"
she winks at me.
"Cost only $500,000.
It seems hard to imagine how any convenience store, even one that can get away with charging $12 for a six-pack of Bud Ice, could be worth $500,000, but Gloria Yu's store probably deserves it if any of them do. Like a ship squeezed inside a bottle, a full-sized supermarket has somehow been folded into the space meant for a restaurant or a flower shop. Thousands of items line the shelves, seemingly one of everything. In my general state of paranoia, it occurs to me that if I were to be trapped in this place by some sort of prolonged emergency, such as a flood or a toxic cloud, I could survive for months, maybe even a year, and find something new to eat each day.
"So,"
Gloria Yu says to me, her voice quivering with excitement,
"this your first store?"
"Yes, it is," I confess guiltily.
"I knew it,"
she says, practically jumping up and down with excitement.
"I knew it, I knew it. You not look like normal deli owner."
A few customers glance nervously our way.
"So where you from?"
Gloria Yu asks me. Boston."
"Boston? Like the Boston, Massachusetts? No, 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 no."
"What do you mean, no, no, no?" I ask impatiently. "That's where I grew up."
"Not where you grow up, where your family from,"
Gloria Yu says.
Readers, thanks so much for joining me today. If you have some extra time over this holiday weekend, check out my website, bookreportradio.com, for ideas on titles that are definitely worth your time. Suggestions for books you'd like me to cover? Drop me a line at elaine@bookreportradio.com or go to the Reader's Corner on my website. I hope you and your family have a wonderful 4th. See you back here next week on The Book Report.